You're listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4. You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Good evening. It's the bright orange patches that catch the eye on the more remote shorelines of the Dodecanese Islands. The people smugglers now often don't bother to land the migrants who paid them so much money for their illegal passage to a new life. Just chuck them in the sea off a Greek island with those orange buoyancy aids they leave behind if they're lucky. I've just spent a month sailing there, listening on the radio to a freighter captain saying he'd picked up 8, but 4 others had drowned. Finding groups of them on cliffs yelling, "Is this Europe? Please help." Huddled outside every island police station, Syrians mostly, escaping civil war and Islamic extremism. It's even worse on the other side of the Mediterranean. Official figures yesterday estimated 100,000 had tried to cross from the North African coast so far this year, crammed into leaky boats. At least 1,600 are thought to have drowned. HMS Bulwark picked up more than 1,000 last weekend. Many Syrians try from there too, along with people escaping Eritrea, which has become one big concentration camp, from Somalia, a failed state, from Libya itself, now an anarchy of competing warlords, and from poverty and violence in other countries too. What can we do is difficult. What should we do? More so. To save lives at sea is a moral imperative as old as humanity, surely without qualification. But does risking your life and bribing a crook put you in a different moral category, give you more of a call on our sympathy and hospitality than those left behind? At what point does an economic migrant become a refugee, or has that distinction become meaningless? What's wrong with wanting a better, safer life? But the numbers are staggering. How could we cope with them all? What do we do about the migrants? That's our moral maze tonight. Our panel, Melanie Phillips, social commentator on The Times, Claire Fox from the Institute of Ideas, Anne McElvoy, public policy editor of The Economist, and the chief executive of the RSA, Matthew Taylor. Panel, I suppose most people would say we can't let people just drown, but what would you do with them? Anne McElvoy, in a nutshell.
Well, that's right. You can't let people just drown, but neither is that really the limit of the moral argument that we're faced with tonight. And short-term palliatives are not the answer. So we do have to get into this very difficult distinction between refugees and migrants. And for those whose lives are not obviously in danger, I'm going to argue that the better ethical position for the longer term and for the good of more people is to return them.
Claire Fox.
Well, the reason why these migrants have to endure these terrible conditions and being smuggled in is because they're not allowed to enter Europe legally. So for me, I'd relax the borders, let people enter legally and try their luck at making a better life here. No drownings, end of problem.
Matthew Taylor.
I think Europe's response to the disasters in Libya and Syria is shameful, and I think we have to save people from drowning, but we also need to try to develop a fair system. And if we do develop such a system, part of that has to be that the people who don't play by the rules face the consequences of not doing so.
Melanie Phillips.
There's no easy or straightforward solution to what we're seeing, which is nothing less than the breakup of the Arab nation state. And we can't take this great flood of humanity that potentially will come our way. But nevertheless, I think there's a difference between refugees and illegal immigrants. And I believe that we have to find ways of combining compassion with realism.
Panel, thanks very much indeed. Our first witness is Martin Schwereb, as former commander of the Armed Forces of Malta, now director of the Migrant Offshore Aid Station, which is a privately financed charity that helps rescue would-be migrants in distress. And he's on the line now from Valletta in Malta. Brigadier Schwereb, you've got a special boat, a couple of inflatables, a drone even, and your hands full at the moment, I imagine.
Yes. Well, in addition, we also have a partnership with Médecins Sans Frontières and we provide post-rescue care. We do have our hands full. As we speak, we're proceeding to the shores of Sicily, having saved 77 people close to the Bourioi fields.
Matthew Taylor, your witness.
Brigadier Schwereb, do you think all the migrants on the boats that you across the Mediterranean that you rescue, are they all equally deserving of our help?
Well, for us, the answer is very simple. Whoever feels compelled for one reason or another to do the crossing for those who feel they have no option but to do the crossing, no one of those people deserves to die out at sea. What we try to do is mitigate loss of life at sea, fully aware that ours is not the solution to migration.
But do you personally make a judgment? If you're rescuing people and you rescue somebody whose life was genuinely at risk, with their children, for example, and next to that is an able-bodied man who has chosen to leave a country which isn't unsafe because they would like a better economic prospect, do you make a distinction in your mind between how deserving those two cases are?
No, we don't at all. First of all, whenever a boat is crossing, if a boat is in distress, if a boat is overloaded, then that is a boat that requires assistance. So in reality, we do not distinguish on who is most deserving to our rescue. Obviously, when you are doing a rescue, you do assess who are the most people in distress and who needs to be rescued first. But essentially, no. If a boat is in distress, then whoever is in that boat needs to be rescued. What happens to those people post disembarkation then is another matter.
But given that you can't return people to Syria or Libya, so therefore, if they are rescued, in a sense, they are achieving their goal of getting into Europe. The point I guess I'm trying to get to here is basically what you're saying is that what gives them the moral imperative is the fact that they're willing to take the risk. They might be taking the risk for all sorts of different reasons, but the fact that they are willing to take the risk of drowning is, for you, as it were, sufficient grounds for us to believe that they are deserving of achieving their outcome, which is to get to Europe.
No, I think, first of all, we need to go back and determine why people are taking the risk. I think this should be our point of departure. We can't see the issue from our eyes. We need to see it from the eyes of those who have either been living for a long time in refugee camps, and there are at the minute about 6 million people living in refugee camps, and that is Syrian alone, or else living in certain conditions in Eritrea. So when you talk about making a choice, you need to see it also from that perspective.
So what choice do
these people have?
Can I follow up precisely that point? So I know this is a long way away from where we are now, but if we were to have a fair system, if Europe was to be accepting the people that it should be accepting in these dire straits, in the context of an entirely fair and reasonable system, would you still believe that we should go to any lengths that we need to rescue people who were choosing to ignore that system and come over on boats?
Well, the thing is, if there is an entirely fair system and a system that works, then people won't take to the sea. People won't be crossing on boats. If there is a system that works, we're a long way away from a system that works. When we get to that point, then we can discuss on that matter.
Anne McElvoy.
Brigadier, are you not worried that in one way you are in danger of making the problem worse because you are picking people up? I'm heading that there's a moral hazard to this so-called pull factor in which you then encourage others to come after until the system can in no way cope with it.
No, I think the issue of the pull factor is now an old argument, and it's rather a tired argument, because what we really need to focus more rather than on the pull factor is on the push factor. We spend time on the boat. We meet these people on the boat. The great, great majority of these people would never leave the country of origin unless they feel compelled to do. People tell us that. If they have food on the table, if they can educate their kids, if they feel safe at home, they won't leave. And I'm talking on the great majority of people who would truly never leave their homeland if they have the basics. So let's talk a bit more about push factors.
Well, I think that you might be underestimating how much these things are interlinked. And at the moment, those push factors, as you rightly say, are considerable. So I wonder whether you might not end up in a position where, as an NGO, you said post-embarkation is another matter. But kind of morally, you've just moved the problem along the lines and handed it over to individual states.
Yes, I can accept that argument. The issue, however, is that if a person dies at sea, all our efforts that happen before and after are futile. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't try harder in solving problems in countries of origin, upstream. That is not the argument. We think that, yes, there should be additional efforts to solve the problems in Syria, in Eritrea, in sub-Saharan Africa, because we truly believe that if the problems are solved upstream, the great majority of people do not leave. However, we also feel that if a person dies at sea, what comes before and what comes after is useless.
But I absolutely understand that, and it's invidious really to argue to the contrary. But are you saying, just to be clear, that the way things are now in the world, and we can't change everything in the world, that you would allow all of those people that you pick up into Europe or into any Western country that would take them? Is that what you're proposing?
What I'm saying is that this is a crisis of mammoth proportions. There are more refugees around the world today than there were post-Second World War. This is a global issue that requires global solutions. And when you are dealing with a crisis, you need to manage the crisis, and you need to manage it in a particular way. This is what I'm saying.
Brigadier Schwereb, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Our next witness is Dr. Tim Stanley, who's a historian and writer for the Daily Telegraph, in which he's made some pretty trenchant criticisms about what's going on. In a nutshell, what are we doing wrong and what should we do?
We're absolutely right, and I accept everything that's just been said by our last witness, that we have a moral imperative to rescue people who are in immediate danger. But the very fact that European nations have recognised after a period that it is their responsibility means they have to tackle two things. One, the push factor, the collapse of North African societies that drives people away, but secondly also the pull factor that makes them go to Europe and allows them to stay in Europe and propagates the idea that there is an alternative life for them in Europe which they can reach after some risk and find some security there.
Claire Fox.
Isn't Dr. Stanley one of the a fairly simple solution to the immediate danger to liberalise Europe's approach to immigration and be as open as possible and just say, come here, and then we wouldn't have this immediate danger to deal with?
Do I take from it that you would actually have ships that ferry people for free from Africa to Europe? Because that's the only way that physically, because we are separated by an ocean, and that's the best way physically.
I'd probably recommend they got a kind of cheap flight. But I mean, the point is, if you were allowed to legally arrive in this country, you wouldn't go to the desperate ends.
Absolutely.
That's a reasonable.
That's entirely
option.
Logical, but it will have profound consequences for European society and the economy, and also for Africa, because you would see the mass migration of skilled people from Africa to Europe, where they know they can make better wages.
Yeah. Just following on, though, is that not a kind of contradiction, a moral contradiction, it seems to me, to people in Africa looking over here, which is there's much moral grandstanding, much made of the fact that Europe believes in open borders, believes in freedom and so on, and yet you've got this fortress Europe, which is we want everyone to be able to free travel, but not you.
Absolutely. I think you're entirely right. There is a grand hypocrisy at the heart of the EU design, that it does indeed claim that it is all about open borders and the free movement seeking work. But in fact, it's a giant protective zone and it keeps people out. I don't dispute that whatsoever. But nonetheless, one might argue that there is a practical reason for that.
But I suppose then to go back to your push-pull and kind of where we're going with that, I mean, it does strike me that the dynamism of those people who prepared to kind of want to improve their lives from Africa, from wherever they're coming in Europe, will inevitably mean that the world is a richer, more dynamic place. I mean, the whole free movement is where people will go to improve their lives, rather than kind of accepting destiny, as it were, and just sticking there and saying, oh, well, the fact that Libya has been destroyed by Western intervention, I'll just stay here and take my lot. Surely you wouldn't want to encourage that kind of moral approach to life.
Well, put it this way. First of all, the fact that people accept large amounts of risk does not necessarily mean they're good people or that they're going to integrate. For instance, the people who recently carried out that fantastic diamond heist took enormous risk and showed great ingenuity. They were not inherently good people.
I was impressed.
You know, I was rather impressed too. But secondly, it made me proud to be British. Secondly, the fact that people are fleeing a bad situation does not necessarily mean they want to make a good situation of where they're going to go to. Thirdly, there are consequences for stresses upon services which the European system simply cannot take. And finally, there is the question of cultural integration.
I think you've raised some very interesting points here. I mean, one of the things I wanted to ask you, though, is if we actually stopped romanticising, because I think there's a danger of, even in what some of the things you've said, which is either criminalising people by, you know, talking about them in a particular way as undeserving, or in some ways more distastefully, romanticising them as victims and almost implying. But that doesn't mean to say that there isn't some objective virtue to be said for those people who prepared to want to change their lives. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't make them good people, but that it's a virtue to try and change the circumstances.
Absolutely, it can be, and there are people who've done that through internal migration in the UK, and there have been people who have transformed whole countries and continents by doing that, for instance, the European movement to America. I'm not disputing that, but when you're talking about a rate of 200,000 people in 2014, you're talking about a dramatic demographic transformation that I'm not sure contemporary modern Europe, with its welfare system, with a labour market that's already very stretched thin, I don't think it can take it.
Melanie Phillips?
That being said, isn't it the case, however, that this country and indeed other countries in the developed world have always been resistant to refugees, even when those numbers were very small? I mean, Jews coming on, my own grandparents and great-grandparents coming from Russia at the turn of the last century. Most countries, vast majority of countries, would not accept refugees from Nazi Germany. So aren't we seeing something that is actually rather unpleasant about the haves in the world towards the have-nots or the desperates?
Well, first of all, I want to make it clear that I do see a distinction between refugee and economic migrant. So in the case of the refugees, I agree with you. I think there should be a common European policy, and I think Britain should take far more, especially from Syria, and indeed any country where it has a hand in the collapse of its state. Second, just because historically something has happened often and has proven a moral point does not mean in the future that it will play out the same way and that it makes the same moral point. So, for instance, in the early 1970s, we had an obligation, because of the collapse of the empire, to take Asian migrants from the African states that were expelling them. The British public, I suspect, does not feel the same when it comes to North African migrants, when it comes to Syrian migrants.
For sure. But let me turn my own question, as it were, backwards. Given that this is, I think I'm right in saying, an unprecedented situation. We're looking at the collapse of the nation state in the Arab world, not to mention dreadful things going on in Africa. We're looking at the potential migration of millions of genuine refugees. Leave aside economic migrants. The number of genuine refugees is potentially enormous. What is our moral responsibility? Given that we can't take them all, what do we do as a developed world towards what's happening, this tragic situation of enormous proportions in the developing world?
And I can give answers to that, but I fear I'd be moving well beyond the realms of this discussion, because we get into discussing how European countries can help develop new nation states. And I'm not sure my expertise extends to that, and it's such a big question. One thing you can do is tie the giving of European aid to better management of a country. Another thing you can do is end certain European policies that protect our industries and our agriculture and trade much better with North Africa, so that its people will be richer. A third thing you can do is to either engage less in some conflict zones or more in others and take a proactive stance against dictatorships like Eritrea. And then we can pick apart the Syrian conflict and discuss the moment at which we should have intervened or not. As I say, I think that goes well beyond the realms of simply what does the European Union do when it comes to refugees. But undeniably, if we're discussing push factors, getting Africa working is part of it.
But you talk about the distinction between economic migrants and refugees in this chaotic situation.
Yes.
How on earth do we distinguish?
We have to try. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but we have to try. And one way we do that is to process people outside of Europe. rather than letting people slip into a system whereby the attempt to get that definition cannot even be done, because once they've arrived at the Italian detention centre, without even being properly processed, they simply disappear into Europe. So, for instance, something like 100,000 people have arrived from Libya to Europe in the last 6 months. Of that, only about 40,000 are currently accounted for. So we're talking about a large number of people who simply don't even go through the process of being assessed as to whether or not they're refugee or an economic migrant. That's the kind of practical thing we need to address.
Dr. Stanley, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Our next witness is Stephen Hale, who's Chief Executive of Refugee Action, a charity which says what it does on the tin, I suppose, supports refugees and helps them to settle in Britain. There are apparently, or so I was reading today, 10 million displaced Syrians. You could say the entire population of places like Eritrea could plausibly be said to have a well-merited fear of persecution. Britain, Europe should take all of them?
You're right. Your figure is correct. There are 10 million displaced Syrians, and of those 10 million people, 2% have applied for asylum in Europe, and 98% have not. They're either settled in other neighbouring countries in the region, or they're internally displaced within Syria itself. So I think, I've been listening obviously to the different contributions you've had so far. One thing that's very striking to me is that among the panel, among the people you've so far spoken to, there's been a consensus that we should resume search and rescue, that people should not drown in the sea. It's only 9 months since there was a consensus among 28 European governments that we should let them drown in the sea. And I think, in a sense, we're growing up. We're beginning to grapple with this. We're rediscovering our moral conscience. And everybody recognises, in late April, Nigel Farage called for several thousand people to be resettled. I think we're shifting this debate. We've got to look at what real solutions there are now.
OK, let's move on to that. Anne McElboy.
Stephen, I think arithmetic involving humans and human destinies is often distasteful, but it's sometimes necessary. Now, the figure that you gave there, I don't want to quarrel with that figure especially, but nonetheless, 2% of a very large number is still a large number of people. Are you saying that morality should not be at all about what is practical in terms of numbers of people you can accept?
2% of 10 million is 200,000. I think that Europe can welcome and support, and should welcome and support, 200,000 Syrians who have applied for asylum here. But what we're also looking at doing, and again, people have talked about this, is at the moment these people have no choice because there are no safe and no legal routes to reach Europe. And what we've got to do is to build a system where there are safe and legal routes, there are choices. People don't aren't at the mercy of smugglers or have to get into rickety boats.
Right. But you don't know how many would then come after, is my point. But what I want to dig down into, if I could, is why do you think we should take them? Not why should we save their lives at sea? Is there a sort of a feeling that you're saying, well, we have it's a bit punitive, you know, you've been involved in international affairs, now you take your medicine. Is there an element of that in the way that you go at this?
I think that if any of us walk out here tonight and a little girl crosses the road in front of a lorry, we'll grab that girl and we'll stop them being run over. And I think when people see pictures on TV of people drowning in the sea, they want to rescue them. But what we've got to do is get beyond that and think, why is that happening? And what are the long-term solutions? And one of the principal long-term solutions is to give people better options than that gamble that they're taking with their lives right now.
That's in the future, but are you saying we've got a responsibility because of the way we in the West have behaved in the past?
No, I'm not saying it's to do with that. I'm saying I think it's a moral responsibility. I think it's a humanitarian response, and I don't think we should get tripped up with theoretical debates, if you like, about what level we might do this. I think we need to engage with it. We need to be a part of it. 43 families have been welcomed and resettled in the UK from Syria. That's a very low number.
The argument came up with the last witness about the necessity of making a distinction, however difficult, between refugees and economic migrants. That's very important, isn't it? Not just in a practical way, but to having some sort of ethical consistency. Because what I'm worried about is if you lump everyone together, you end up with a very big moral platitude that we should all be here to help and endlessly take any number of people, and we can argue about the figures. Yeah. But that seems to me to be very undifferentiated, and morality has to be practical if it's to mean something.
I agree with that. Clearly, there is an international definition of a refugee. It's someone who's fleeing war, who's fleeing persecution, whose own government will no longer support them, and whose life is at risk, who have significant grounds for those kinds of fears. An economic migrant is clearly moving in order to find a better life. You can't, as you heard from your first interviewer, you can't make that assessment when somebody's in the sea, but you can make an assessment once they reach shore.
Matthew Taylor? Can I ask you an entirely hypothetical question? I'm sorry if it seems a bit objectionable, but I'm interested. If you had £1 million to give away and you had to choose between giving it to a refugee camp in Jordan for refugees who accepted the rules or more boats for those who didn't play by the rules, where would you donate that £1 million?
It's a hypothetical question, but it's a real one. And in the UK, we're making some financial investments in helping people to resettle directly from those refugee camps. And we're also obviously providing international aid. I think that we do need more safe and legal routes. I don't think we're spending enough on giving people who meet very strict criteria an opportunity to resettle and to rebuild their lives. And at Refugee Action, we're the leading organisation in the UK in giving that practical support, almost overwhelmingly to families who meet those criteria.
So I entirely agree with you about safe and fair routes, but I'm interested in what people are concerned about. Is they're concerned about not just social justice, but they're concerned about what's called procedural justice, playing by the rules. Do you recognise that it's valid for people to say, if you've got a system, people should try to adhere to it, and you shouldn't give priority to people who try to circumvent it?
I think we need a rules-based system, no question about that. But as you were saying earlier in the programme, we're a very, very long way from a fair system. Either a fair system for people who are refugees in the first place and often stuck sometimes for decades in refugee camps, or a fair system for people who are forced to flee because there are no legal routes and then arrive in the UK. So we must build a fair system.
Do you think that if people feel that interventions are futile, that is to say that you take people out of the water and then just more come and more come and more come, does that undermine ultimately people's humanitarian capacities? Do they just kind of give up, shrug their shoulders?
I think we saw in late April when 28 governments changed their view on search and rescue, and all political parties in the UK, with a lot of engagement from the media, you know, supported that decision. I think we saw a shift, but there are things that are getting in the way of people's compassion. Clearly, there is anxiety about, well, how many might come if we change our approach, if we welcome refugees to the UK? How many is that going to be? If you look at the proposal that's come from the European Union, they've asked Britain to resettle 2,309 people over 2 years. Now, people's reaction to that...
So I understand the point you're making, and I agree with it, but can I ask you the same question I asked Brigadier Schwerb earlier, which was, if there was a fair and reasonable system, if we were taking the numbers you think we should take, in those circumstances, would you still believe that we should lift anybody out of the sea, even if it was clear that they were simply doing it to circumvent the rules, they knew the risks that they were taking?
Quite difficult to make that assessment while somebody's in the water.
I understand that, but in a perfect system, that's what I'm asking you, would it still be the case that people choosing to put their life at peril would be a moral imperative that requires us to go to every effort to save them?
I think that when we reach the point at which there is a fair system, which people can resettle, they're no longer forced to take these desperate choices, then, you know, people will be in a different position. And as you said, we should be able to make... I think his response, which I entirely agreed with, was that people can make that assessment on shore, then they won't be making that journey because they'll know what might happen on the other side. So if we have a fair system, people won't be taking a gamble which they know is going to lead to a different an outcome that they're not seeking.
Stephen Hale, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Our last witness is Professor Paul Collier, who's Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford and author of Exodus, Immigration and Multiculturalism in the 21st Century, which is squarely in the middle of the subject we're doing tonight. He's on the line from Oxford. Professor Collier, do we have any moral duty to accept people in poor countries who want to... understandably, perhaps, want a better, safer life for them and their families?
I think we have two moral duties. The first one is indeed a duty to rescue, but the people we should be focusing on rescuing are not the 2% of refugees who get on boats. It's the 100% of refugees who are displaced, and that means the weight of our effort should be on the 98% who don't get on the boats, who end up in refugee camps in Jordan or Turkey or whatever. I was in one of the refugee camps, the biggest, in Jordan last month, and where treating them very badly at the moment, these refugees. They're not being rescued. Materially, they're being fed, but they have no chance to rescue their lives because they're not allowed to work.
And the second moral point?
The second moral point is thou shalt not tempt. And at the moment, we've got a ridiculous policy in which our duty of rescue is reduced to tempting, and 2% of displaced people are tempted, and it's a temptation that you can go to heaven. Heaven means get a job in Germany for life, but in order to do that, you've got to have enough cash to pay several thousand dollars to a crook to get on a boat, and then you've got to be able to swim. And a lot of people drown.
Let me stop you there. Melanie Phillips?
Taking your point that our policy towards the landlocked refugees is highly questionable, the question therefore nevertheless remains, what would you do with these people who are fleeing into boats and drowning? Would you send them back? Would you blow up the boats? Would you try and find safe havens for them? What would you do?
There's an absolute moral duty to get them out of the sea. Huh? There's also an absolute moral duty not to tempt them onto those boats in the first place. Once they're out of the sea, they should be placed in a safe haven which gives them a viable life. That's what refugee camps properly run would do. They provide people with jobs, with a future, where what we would be doing in those refugee camps is not just preserving people's physical existence, but incubating the post-conflict Syrian economy. Quite probably in about 4 years, Syria will be back out of conflict. It's a middle-income country. Middle-income conflicts don't usually go on that long.
Well, that's as may be, or Syria may in fact collapse into complete chaos. But let's not go there for the moment. Thou shalt not tempt. Why do you think, given what's going on in Syria, given what's going on in other countries of unspeakable barbarism, why do you think that these people are being tempted? Why don't you think they're being pushed rather than pulled? Surely there's enough, for goodness sake, to push them into desperate measures.
10 million people are being pushed, and only 2% of those people are actually getting on boats. They're the people who are being tempted by the lure of something way beyond the duty of rescue. The chance of a permanent life in Germany is not rescue, it's temptation. These people have the chance of going to heaven, but only if they bribe a crook and take an unacceptable risk.
Claire Vox?
The thou shalt not tempt could alternatively be, surely thou shall dream, thou shall aspire. I mean, what on earth gives us the right to demand that people not want to improve their circumstances?
Of course people want to improve their circumstances. That's fine. That doesn't mean that we have a moral duty to fulfil every dream.
Well, it's not all about us. No disrespect.
I'm sorry, but 40% of people in poor countries would rather live in rich ones, right?
Now, well, that's an eminently sensible conclusion.
Of course. If you were living in a poor country, if I was, I'd certainly want to dream of moving to a rich country. But that's not a viable solution. The struggle is to make these poor countries catch up with the rest of us. That's the vital thing.
And Professor Collier, I have huge admiration for your arguments about the need for development in those countries and wanting to encourage it as much as possible. I'm simply making the point that to actually say the way that we have to stop, however, in the interim, while we're waiting for that development, which, by the way, the West has put all sorts of barriers in the way of that
Quite
development.
Right.
In the meantime, I would want those people who have the guile, the gumption, the determination to improve things to not be treated as passive, you know, don't tempt them, then they won't come. Surely we should actually celebrate and welcome people taking those kind of decisions. They're the people who'll develop their countries.
They won't develop their countries if they're not in them.
You can develop from afar. I mean, I believe that there are academics, as we speak, such as yourself, who are doing quite a lot to encourage development, and maybe some of those people from Africa can come and join you and help even more actively.
And plenty do, and that's great. But the real struggle is within these countries. They need their people, their young people with initiative and education, to lift them out of poverty. And so tempting the brightest and the best to leave their countries, tempting the doctors to leave Africa and come and practice in London is very nice for the doctors. It's not a great moral position for ordinary people in Africa. We shouldn't be celebrating that.
Professor Collier, thanks very much for joining us tonight. OK, panel, what do we make of all this? Can we get rid of the first and easier moral issue? Do any of you, having listened to the arguments, think there is a moral hazard in pulling people out of the water and not letting them drown?
No, I don't think there's any question that you would pull people out of the water. But I do think that it is important to recognise that when you do that, you are responding to, as it were, a lesser moral... You're responding to the fact that people have been willing to take a risk. You are not responding to a kind of overall coherent kind of moral system which says that there are certain people who are deserving. And so, of course, we would all rescue those people, but we might, at the same time as rescuing them, that recognise that in the act of rescuing them, we are making it more difficult to put a moral system in place.
I think the problem is not the pulling them out of the water. The problem is that once they're pulled out of the water, they think that they are going to be able to get to Europe, the promised land. And I think that is...
And they are.
And I think there is, you know, throughout this whole conversation, there's been this elision between immigration and refugees, between economic migrants and people fleeing proper war and persecution. And personally, I think there must be a distinction made. I think it's very difficult to make it. But the thing that really strikes me is fine to rescue people who are true refugees, but, and this kind of bears what Professor Collier was saying, but it also bears on what Stephen Hale was saying. Stephen Hale was saying these people need safe routes to Europe. Why to Europe? Why not safe routes to countries which aren't in Europe, which are in the developing world, but which aren't in Europe? In other words, there seems to be a confusion by him or his side of the argument that says that these people don't just need to be rescued to be safe, but they do have an entitlement to come to Europe to better themselves. Now, that's a very different matter.
Anne?
Saving a life is not the same as having an entitlement to effectively to then be able to apply for citizenship. And I think the two-tier moral problem that we've all struggled with and the witnesses have had to go around tonight is that clearly the act of saving a life is a moral act, and we would be right to support it, and we should involve ourselves in so doing. So I think it would be fair to say the fact that Europe looked away from that, which was a point that Stephen Hale made, was bad. That was an immoral treatment. But the second tier and the second order problem is the bigger one, which is the then what do you do? And that's where we got into that tension about do you try to handle the problem by saying, in effect, let them all in, which is really what Brigadier Schwerb was saying. He said, it's not my problem what happens. Someone is basically going to have to deal with this. Or do we say, no, we are going to be quite tough-minded about this and a lot of people are going to be returned and that we hope that that's the beginning of a different situation?
Claire, I want to come to you, but we want to move it on a bit. A distinct disagreement between the first two witnesses, Brigadier Schwerb and Dr. Stanley, both impressive with their arguments, I thought. But Brigadier Schwerb, who was actually at the sharp end, sees these refugees and everything, reckons the idea of a pull factor, as we classified it, is a tired argument, but Dr. Stanley reckoned it was had a big impact.
I simply think that they both exist. You know, that there is undoubtedly the case that the refugee crisis, that part of it, has undoubtedly gone up since the falling apart of certain parts of the world, and the Melanie's talked about that, what's happening in the Middle East and so on. That's a part of it. But it's not just that, and we know that this existed before the kind of Libya, Syria and disasters and ISIS and the barbarism going on in certain parts of the world. And that was very much that people, and that's why I would actually defend economic migrants. I don't like this deserving and undeserving. I think it's perfectly reasonable to make a distinction between them, but I just think it's, you end up in this situation whereby there's something distasteful about wanting to improve your life from starvation and want your kids to go to Oxford, rather than kind of having to show your wounds and say, I'm suffering persecution and people being forced in that. But one thing I think that's difficult is that I do understand that there's an irritating debate that's taken place recently where people have said, well, you know, nation states are not entitled to control their borders. I mean, that's what European countries are often told. You know, you've got no choice, we've got free movement, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you're an elected democratic government, you're not allowed. But I think that muddies the water, because having said that, then Europe basically erects this thing. So I say, let everybody in, but you have to stop at the border and talk to someone. Perfectly reasonable.
I want to do a bit more on whether there is a distinction between an economic migrant and a refugee. But Anne McElvoy, the point you had with Stephen Hare, which I thought was an interesting moral question about the arithmetic of morality, where principle has to give way to practicality. Where did you stand on that?
Well, the reason that I asked that was that I know I feel so, you know, very divided about it myself. But I do think, and the word distasteful or invidious, or all these sort of ways that we sometimes say, I just feel uncomfortable about this, has come up for most of us tonight. I think that there is actually a sort of arithmetical component here, simply because this is possibly where I disagree with what Claire's just said, that in the end, I think an unmanaged migration of putting everyone together and saying, well, whether you're an economic migrant or a refugee, it doesn't matter, you should have the chance to enter certain countries, seems to me just to be, it's so unrealistic that I think the moral grounds on which it stands get eaten away. The public sees through it, it creates other problems which can then also lead to very undesirable outcomes. So yes, I think that however uncomfortable we feel about it, there is an arithmetic
here. But I thought your point, Anne, about practical morality is well made, and I wonder whether in a sense there's bad faith on both sides of this argument. You see, you know, I don't know, I haven't read all Tim Stanley's work, but I suspect he hasn't written a great deal about what a fair system in which Britain were to accept its fair share of Libyan and Syrian. You know, he's not interested in designing such a system. He's interested in condemning the people who behave in a way that they do because there is no system. And on the other hand, it feels to me as though, you know, Stephen Hale, Brigadier Schwab, they accept in abstract the idea that in a perfect system you'd have to observe the rules, but you kind of sense that they will always say the system isn't perfect and therefore you can't enforce the rules. So what you really need is you need people who are committed to trying to put in place a system that is as good as it can possibly be and some set of rules that people are required to adhere to. But there's a kind of gap there between people rather adopt positions than engage in the practical challenge.
And getting back to that distinction between an economic migrant and a refugee, is it still possible to do that when you have countries like Eritrea and what's happening in Syria, Claire?
Well, that's the thing.
Is it useful in the first place, and is it possible in the second?
I think it's very difficult to do it practically, but I think morally it's unhelpful. And I do think it, that's what I'm saying, is I think it almost forces people to kind of play the victim card. I mean, that's what I fear about
it.
I think that, however, you know, if you can notice differences, but I think that there's a danger, because even the way we've taught our compassion for them, we're rescuing them, it always makes it them as though they're kind of passive. The very last thing these people are is passive. Yeah. They've got quite a lot of,
I think, the distinction is absolutely vital. But trying to better yourself is very commendable. We can all have sympathy, and there may be advantages to us in taking such people. But we have a moral duty to people whose lives are in danger. And that's where this becomes very, very difficult, because we can't take them all.
And McElvoy, bringing this back to our starting point, I suppose, the rather telling phrase of Professor Collier, the last witness, thou shalt not tempt, as a moral duty. Do you think that was a valid thing to be saying.
I do, actually. I'm pleased that he put it so succinctly, because one thing that he's effectively touching on there, which we haven't discussed, is, you know, where does this leave the moral status of encouraging people traffickers? We've talked a lot about the refugees or the economic migrants, quite rightly. They're at the sharp end of it. But you are, I think, then, as he suggests, encouraging people to exploit into terrible and exploitative practices, and you can't look away from that. I think sometimes we can get ourselves into a slight sort of piety where we look at only at one side of this equation. There are some pretty bad and immoral things.
But let's remember those
there.
People. Those people, traffickers, are responding to huge demand. And in the end, what I take out of all of this is that the first moral step is for Britain to take its share of this tragedy.
OK, that's it for this week. From our panel, Melanie Phillips, Claire Fox, Anne McElvoy, and Matthew Taylor, and from me, till the same time next week, goodbye.